From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Early in the morning when I open my eyes, only one thing is on my mind. Only one thing gets me out of my bed. Strong cup of java about the size of my head.
Roughly 85% of us use some kind of caffeine to get us kick-started in the morning, not to mention all those little pick-me-ups throughout the day, which makes caffeine the most popular drug by far in the U.S. And what delivery mechanism do most of us choose to transport our drug of choice? Coffee. This hour, we'll explore the influence coffee's had on culture, from the trading routes of the Ottoman Empire to the slave plantations of Brazil, and even to the breakfast tables of revolutionary America.
I actually found John Adams writing to Abigail saying, I'm going to have to get used to drinking coffee now because it's unpatriotic to drink tea.
And a scientist will tell you what you really want to hear, that caffeine is actually really, really good for you.
I want a strong cup of java about the size of my head.
Celebrated chef Charlie Trotter says you must make certain assumptions about the ingredients in his recipes. For example, all cream is heavy, all pepper is freshly ground, all herbs are fresh, and the olive oil is extra virgin. So I asked coffee aficionado Timothy Castle if we should make any assumptions about the coffee.
The coffee has to be fresh. Nothing beats having coffee that's roasted within a week, you know, a week to 10 days. And after that, it really isn't, it doesn't have the life in it, the dynamism and the flavor and the complete freedom of spoilage and oxidation. Yes, it's the same model as extra virgin olive oil. You can't fake that or replace that with some other thing. You know, packaging coffee, no matter what you do, you lose the vitality, I guess is the best word for it.
How much difference does the roasting process make? I mean, if you start with great beans, does it matter who cooks it for you?
Well, I've compared that to winemakers. And winemaking, they have to buy good grapes. And coffee roasting, they have to buy good coffee. But the winemaker and the coffee roaster have a very big impact on what that coffee will taste like. And they have some interpretive leeway.
And brewing, are you a drip grind or an espresso brew? Do you have a favorite?
My favorite is brewing a very strong cup of coffee through a paper filter, a rinsed paper filter. You rinse it first with boiling hot water, run the water through it like a pot of water through it, and you can run hot water in through the filter into just a thermos carafe, and then empty that all out and put the grounds in to the wet but, you know, drained filter in the funnel, and then just brew the coffee with boiling water off the stove. Let it cool down for a few seconds, and then brew your coffee that way. And I use about 4 ounces of coffee for about a 50-ounce pot.
I suppose I should also ask you if you should store coffee at home. I mean, you go buy a pound of beans. It was recommended to me at one point that you put them in the freezer. Is that still true?
Well, you know, if you're going to keep your coffee around for a long time for some reason, but I don't know why you would, because if you're using a good amount of coffee and making a pot of it every morning, you'll go through that coffee in less than a week. Think of it as freshly baked bread. You know, you wouldn't normally want to freeze your bread unless you're going away or you only use one slice a day and you don't want it to get stale. Yeah, then maybe you put it in your freezer. But otherwise, you leave it on the counter, you leave it in a cool, dry place, preferably out of the sunlight, and you use it up quickly, and then you get more.
Yeah.
Coffee has an immediacy to it. You use it immediately after it's roasted. You want to drink it immediately after it's brewed. There's an urgency to it, and you need to respect that if you want a great-tasting cup of coffee.
You know, one of the things that's really popular these days is flavored coffees and lattes, the steamed milk that's added. What do you think? Is flavored coffee worth drinking?
Well, flavored coffee is very popular in this country. I think 50% of all the whole bean coffee that Americans buy today is flavored, you know, with hazelnut or raspberry or vanilla or cinnamon or something. It got its start in the early 70s when the market went up. I think it was due to a frost. and roasters wanted to start using cheaper coffee, and someone got the bright idea of flavoring it to give this cheaper coffee an edge in the market, and it became very popular. But it's not, you know, I don't consider it, and nobody in the roasting business, a lot of them sell it because it's popular and they want to make money, but it's not considered a great thing because it doesn't, you know, it's like flavored wine. And if you can put it in that context, I think you start understanding pretty quick what it's all about.
What about the coffee that I think an awful lot of people now buy coffee with milk in it? Does that change coffee in good ways?
Some people, even some people in the coffee business, have the, you know, like milk in their coffee. I drink it in the morning when I'm in a hurry because I don't burn my mouth with a hot cup of coffee. I cool it down. There's certain coffees that I think go better with milk than others. I like the full-bodied, low-acid coffees with milk. Some people in the coffee business have told me that milk neutralizes some of the acidity in the higher-acid coffees, but I tend not to like milk in a great Costa Rican or Guatemalan coffee. But some of the fuller-bodied coffees, Brazilian coffees, can do very well. It's a matter of choice, I think. I think milk has become very popular because it's a friendlier drink. It's not as challenging. You can adapt to that flavor, especially when the coffee's brewed strong. So it's more accessible to people that aren't dyed-in-the-wool coffee lovers.
More like drinking a wine cooler than a fine wine.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. That's more the coffee-flavored coffee realm, but it's sort of somewhere in between. You know, everyone in the coffee business, I was talking to someone that is chairman of a very well-respected West Coast coffee company the other evening, and he shyly admitted that he was drinking a cappuccino the other morning instead of espresso, and I won't say who it was.
Timothy James Castle is the author of The Perfect Cup, a coffee lover's guide to buying, brewing, and tasting.
I like the coffee. I like the tea. I like the Java and the Java, it likes me. Coffee and tea, and the Java and me. Cup, 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 I will bring you your good morning coffee. Could you smile, smile, smile?
In the midst of the green desert, Miguel's land is filled with trees. Tall ones tower over a spreading canopy of smaller ones. Everywhere there are bromeliads and birdsong. A soft light falls on the thriving coffee plants. Perched on a branch, a small thrush says its name over and over again. Chinchiling, chinchiling.
That's Julia Alvarez reading from her novella, A Cafecito Story. Alvarez spent her childhood in the Dominican Republic. Then her parents had to flee for political reasons, and the family settled in the United States. Today, Julia Alvarez is a successful writer and the author of the novel How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, but she maintains a tie to her native land. She and her husband raise coffee on a small farm there. Anne Strainchamps asked her how she manages it all.
So here you are, a writer, a novelist, a poet, and you're off in the Dominican Republic, and suddenly you bought land and you're coffee farming?
Well, it started out very small. We thought, yeah, you know, why not make a contribution and have a little plot of land? Wouldn't that be neat? You know, it would be nice to be self-serving and say, oh, we were really into this whole green movement. You know, we had basically our hearts in the right place, but we thought, hey, this would be neat. Tell the friends we're growing coffee in the Dominican Republic. Maybe bring up a few bags. Little did we know what we were getting into. And suddenly, you know, we had 250 acres abandoned, deforested, dead land. And we started planting trees. And suddenly we were, you know, part of a thriving little cooperativo. And yeah, we were in it over our ears.
Tell me about A Cafecito Story, the story that came out of your experience.
Well, I thought I could get off easy, write an essay for maybe some magazine. But my husband kept bugging me. He kept saying, you could tell a really neat story. Come on, you could tell a really neat story. And finally, he bugged me so much, I said, I can't help telling a story. I can't help lying in order to tell the truth. In other words, telling a fictional story. You write the afterword that tells what we really did. And I'll write the story at the beginning. And I think of it, I mean, we started talking about it, and suddenly I started thinking, well, you know, I'll write a green fable. A green fable. And that somehow got me started. Miguel's house is made of pine wood. The roof is zinc. The door is opened. There are no electric wires, no telephone poles. Miguel smiles and welcomes half a dozen kids around him. Carmen, his wife, is out back boiling rábanos for supper. A buen tiempo, Miguel says. You have come at a good time. Supper is a bowl of víveres, the boiled roots that the family is accustomed to eating in the evenings. Afterwards, Joe learns about Miguel's farm, planted with coffee the old way, under shade trees that offer natural protection to the plants, filtering the sun and the rain, feeding the soil and preventing erosion, not to mention attracting birds that come to sing over the cherries. That makes for a better coffee, Miguel explains. When a bird sings to the cherries as they are ripening, it is like a mother singing to her child in the womb. The baby is born with a happy soul. The shaded coffee will put that song inside you, Miguel continues. The sprayed coffee tastes just as good if you are only tasting with your mouth, but it fills you with a poison swimming around in that dark cup of disappointment. So why doesn't everyone farm coffee in the old way? Joe asks. The new way, you can plant more coffee. You don't have to wait for trees. You can have quicker results. You can have more money in your pocket. Miguel keeps pointing at Joe when he says, you.
So it's, we bear a heavy load of responsibility, huh?
Well, we are the consumers who have the money to buy these commodities. And it's interesting that after oil, coffee is the most heavily traded commodity on this earth. So we have this power as consumers to say something about how this product that we're buying, how it gets to our cup or to our table. And we are a sleeping giant, really, who could reconfigure markets by the dint of our demands. To use the expression, we should wake up and smell the coffee. We have this power.
And creating the farm has been about more than just planting coffee trees. For instance, when you arrived, most of the people in the community didn't even know how to read or write.
And we got very involved with the planting of trees and beginning to recover the land and helping with the farmers. And then as we got more involved with the cooperativo, we started to realize that nobody knew how to read or write. Adults, children, nobody. Was almost total illiteracy. The ones who know how to read and write can draw their names. That's the way I think of it. So we said, here we are. Can we really be sustainable when we're taking such good care of the natural environment? But what about the human environment? So we set up a school on the farm, and we got a pledge from all the farmers in the cooperativo that everybody would be trying to learn to read and write. By the time Miguel and Carmen and their children have learned to write their names, the little seeds have sprouted. When the trees are a foot high, the family has struggled through a sentence. All of them can read a page by the time the trees reach up to Miguel's knees. When the coffee is as tall as little Miguelina, they have progressed to chapters. In 3 years, by the time of the first coffee harvest from trees Joe has planted, Miguel and Carmen and their children can read a whole book. It is amazing how much better coffee grows when sung to by birds, or when, through an open window, comes the sound of a human voice reading words on paper that still holds the memory of the tree it used to be.
What's happened with the coffee that you're growing? You've called your coffee farm Alta Gracia, right?
Right, we've called it Altagracia, and it's actually, the name comes from the patron saint of the island, La Virgencita de la Altagracia. Many countries, especially Latin American countries, have these virgencitas that appeared on their soil, like the Guadalupe in Mexico, and we have La Virgencita de la Altagracia. So when we got to this deforested, abandoned farmland, we thought we really need some help here. And so we named the farm after the national Virgencita, whose name is Altagracia, which translated means of high grace. And we figured we were high up in the mountains of the central mountain range.
So we needed some high grace.
and also, you know, we wanted Altagracia to be a place of grace. We wanted it to be a sustainable place where, you know, we could model ways of being a community, of being sustainable, of taking care of each other, which would spread grace.
And what about in terms of your writing? I mean, are these now two separate occupations that you have, coffee grower and sustainable activist and writer, or has this whole experience kind of infused your writing in any particular way?
Well, that's a big, huge question. I think of this phrase that's the last line in a message by Hopi elders to the people in their tribe when they were facing a hard time in their history. And the last line of the message is, "We are the ones we have been waiting for." And that's a phrase that has really become my mantra, you know. How do I live a sustainable life, a life that I can live with? I'm getting older. What does it mean to become an elder in the tribe? What are my responsibilities? You know, what are the things that I want to, with the time left me, the energy left me, the talent left me, what are the things I want to do with that energy? How do I pass on to the next generation a more sustainable and just world? I mean, I know I'm not going to do it myself. I'm one of the little laborers putting the stone in the cathedral. But hey, who's going to do it if we don't do it?
One thing I've learned from the life I've lived, the world can only be saved by one man or woman putting a seed in the ground or a story in someone's head or a book in someone's hands. Don't give up on a dream and dream big. Read this book while sipping a cup of great coffee grown under birdsong. Then close your eyes and listen for your own song. As for this book, pass it on.
Julia Alvarez is the author of the novella A Cafecito Story, a story of love, coffee, birds, and hope. And Strange Chance spoke with her.
Just around the corner, there's a rainbow in the sky. So let's have another cup of coffee, and let's have another piece of pie.
Coming up, the history of coffee, from the humble hills of Ethiopia to the barista at Starbucks, and a few stops in between.
Eventually, coffee did come to Europe in a big way around 1650, and for the next 50 years, it revolutionized Western Europe's culture.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Coffee is the second most traded commodity in the world. It has dominated the economies, politics, and social structures of entire nations, more often than not leaving a sad saga of repression and poverty for the poor laborers who cultivate it on tropical mountainsides. So, how did coffee become so powerful? When he spoke with Steve Paulson, investigative journalist Mark Pendergrast started at the beginning with the legends of the origins of coffee.
My favorite story is of Kaldi the goatherd, who was an Ethiopian goatherd who saw his goats acting very bizarrely on the mountainside one day. They were jumping up on their hind legs and butting each other and acting very strange. So he looked carefully and he noticed that they were eating the berries and the leaves of this tree, rather short tree, that grows wild on the mountainsides there. And it turned out to be coffee, and so the story is that he tried the berries out and the leaves, and he started spouting poetry and running around and feeling all energized, and lo and behold, that was how coffee was discovered. If you ever have seen wild goats in Ethiopia, it's not so wild of a story, and the leaves do contain caffeine. But it was the imams, the Sufi monks, used coffee before anybody else to keep them awake for their midnight prayers.
And coffee did actually originate in Ethiopia, right?
Yes, it did. There's no question that coffee still grows wild in Ethiopia. From there, it made the jump across the Red Sea to Yemen, where they began to cultivate it. So the Arabs were the ones who first used coffee as a trade item. At first, it was taken as sort of a tea made with the leaves or with the dried husk of the berries. Nobody did anything with the seed until probably by accident somebody threw it in a fire and it smelled good and they decided to grind it up and put it with some hot water. That probably occurred sometime in the 1400s.
And Yemen really controlled the world of coffee for a long time, didn't it?
Yes, it did. They deliberately would make the beans infertile before they exported them. They would parboil them or something along those lines because they didn't want anyone else to be able to cultivate them. Eventually, the Dutch smuggled some fertile beans out, and they began to grow coffee in the East Indies, in Java and Ceylon, and they broke the back of the monopoly.
Tell me a little bit about this culture of coffee in the Ottoman Empire when the Turks were occupying Yemen and the position that coffee held in that culture.
Well, the Turks were the ones who really spread coffee all over the Ottoman Empire. And when the first travelers from Western Europe went there, which was in the late 1500s, early 1600s, they brought back reports of this very strange black bitter beverage that these people sat around drinking all day long, which apparently was very good for their health and made them very loquacious, but which tasted terrible as far as they could tell. Eventually, coffee did come to Europe in a big way around 1650, and for the next 50 years, it revolutionized Western Europe's culture, beginning in England, but very quickly taking over in France, Italy, Germany, Austria, and wherever it went, it had a remarkable effect, I would argue, on Western civilization. Up until then, people were drunk a lot of the time. They began breakfast with beer soup and proceeded to drink a lot of alcohol during the rest of their day.
So coffee actually started to replace alcohol at a certain point.
Well, at a very specific point between 1650 and 1700. By 1700, there were 2,000 coffee houses in London alone. It had a remarkable effect, and arguably, you know, a lot of music was composed to the strains of coffee, if you want to put it that way. Bach and Beethoven were addicted to it. The French Revolution and the American Revolution were both planned in coffee houses over coffee. And a lot of business began in coffee houses. Lloyd's of London began in Lloyd's Coffee House.
And yet today, when we think of England, we think of tea, not coffee.
That's true. It's interesting. I think what happened to England is that the coffee houses evolved into private men's clubs. They never did allow women into them. And beginning in the early 1700s, you had public tea gardens that were much more open to women and children. Also, tea is a lot easier to prepare without ruining it. Coffee is more delicate. And finally, you had the British East India Company pushing tea.
Now, we know that centuries ago, the Catholic Church had tremendous influence on all parts of life in Europe. Did the Church have strong feelings about coffee?
Well, at the onset, there were a number of people who felt that the Pope should condemn coffee as a heathen beverage because, you know, here were these evil Arabs drinking it. Reputedly, instead, the Pope drank it and said that, oh, this is so good, we can't let this be called a Satan's drink. We shall bless it and make it Christian. So from the very beginning, it was accepted within Christian circles.
Coffee today, of course, is grown all over the world, and various countries are famous for their coffees, Jamaica, Indonesia, Hawaii, Brazil. How did coffee reach some of these far-flung places?
There was a French lieutenant named Mathieu Duclos who became obsessed with bringing coffee to Martinique. And there's a very dramatic story of him guarding his coffee plant from thieves who ripped off one of the stems of it, and he had to give it half of his water during a drought, and there was a major storm, and pirates came aboard the boat. Finally, he got his precious coffee plant over to Martinique, and he grew it. and it propagated and it did very well. This is a very romantic story. Unfortunately, what happened in the Caribbean and elsewhere in the New World was that most of the coffee was grown by black slaves who were brought over from Africa. They were already working in the sugar plantations. Now they started working in the coffee plantations. So by 1790, half of the world's coffee was being grown on one small island called San Domingo, which is now called Haiti. And the next year, they rose up in the only major successful slave rebellion in history. And they burned all of the plantations, and they destroyed their economy, which is one of the reasons why Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere today.
So coffee is really central to the history of slavery in this part of the world.
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, the Brazilians kept slavery until 1888, strictly because of coffee, making them the last country to ban slavery in this hemisphere.
And now Brazil is one of the major coffee producers in the world.
Yeah, by the late 1800s, Brazil was growing 80% of all the world's coffee. And Brazil is still the world's largest producer of coffee, although certainly not that percentage. Again, let me point out that this was not altogether a good thing. It produced some very, very wealthy plantation owners who had huge spreads built on the back of impoverished first slaves and then other laborers who weren't paid very much, called colonos. Also, because Brazil really relied on what amounted to a monoculture, they stopped growing even subsistence crops. And so when the price of coffee went down, which it did at the beginning of the 20th century, they were faced with a devastating consequence. There was almost a revolution. And what they ended up doing was keeping back part of their harvest, trying to raise the price. What happened in the United States was that we acted as if our birthright was to have very cheap coffee. And throughout American history, whenever the price of coffee has spiked up quickly, there have been government investigations. I can't think of another product, aside from perhaps oil, where that might be the case.
So coffee, in a sense, becomes a tool of foreign policy.
There's no question at all that Americans have become involved in a lot of foreign policy, specifically because of coffee. During the Cold War period, we actually tried to keep the price of coffee up, at least to some sort of reasonable level where people wouldn't completely starve to death. And we didn't do that out of humanitarian concerns. We did it because we were afraid that if the price of coffee went too low, Africa and Asia and Latin America would all go communist. We backed out of that agreement in 1989 when the Cold War was ending. And the price of coffee has been terrible ever since, pretty much.
When did people in the United States actually start drinking coffee? When did it really catch on in this country?
Well, the Boston Tea Party, believe it or not, really did have a lot to do with it. I thought that was a myth when I started doing my research, but I actually found John Adams writing to Abigail saying, I'm going to have to get used to drinking coffee now because it's unpatriotic to drink tea. And that became sort of a patriotic symbol.
And it's always interesting to speculate on why a certain culture gravitates to coffee rather than, say, tea.
Well, it's funny also how a different drink will get a different image. Somebody who drinks coffee is, you know, there's certain American qualities associated with it, so that coffee is for sort of the Wild West and somebody who's strong and aggressive and, you know, really going to go out there and get them. Tea has this image of being more gentle and effete.
Now, for much of the 20th century, coffee was the kind of thing that you'd find in diners. I guess that's where we really associate it, in those free refills of Folgers. And then at some point, it suddenly turned into something very shishi, very gourmet. You went to get your double mocha skim lattes at Starbucks. How did it make that jump from diner to fancy coffee shop?
Well, you have to go back even further and look at exactly what happened and the nature of coffee. Coffee, by its very nature, is a very delicate product that can be ruined almost anywhere along the line. But once you roast it, it begins to go stale within a week or so if you allow oxygen to get to it. So the coffee that we were getting in cans by the time of World War II, it wasn't bad, but it wasn't really very good. It certainly wasn't fresh roasted, fresh ground coffee. Then, after World War II, you began to have instant coffee, along with this craze for everything instant. And because that was so bad, they began to put more and more poor quality Robusta beans not only into the instant coffee, but into the regular blends. I mentioned before that every time the price of coffee goes up, we go crazy in America. Well, that happened in 1950 and in 1954. And we had congressional hearings, but also as a result of that, the major roasters, the Maxwell House and the Folgers, began to put worse and worse coffee in to try to cut costs. And they essentially ruined coffee. By the 70s, when you went and had a cup of coffee, it was weak, it tasted horrible, and it was just something that you had the cheapest way that you could get. And so the time was ripe for a rediscovery of what coffee could really be. And so these little hippie roasters began to pop up in the 60s and 70s, and Starbucks was one of them. Starbucks began in 1971. And they were just basically people who were rediscovering the joys of decent coffee. It turned into what you've just described, which is sort of an effete snobbery where people are paying a whole lot of money for good coffee. But hey, at least we're getting decent coffee now.
Mark Pendergrast is the author of Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
Way down among Brazilians, coffee beans grow by the billions, so they've got to find those extra cups to fill. They've got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. You can't get cherry soda, 'cause they've got to sell their quota, and the way things are, I guess they never will. They've got a zillion tons of coffee in Brazil.
More and more people are waking up to Juan Valdez and his 100% Colombian coffee.
Every day I wake up, pour myself a cup of that rich Folgers aroma, the best part of waking up.
Chock full of nuts is that heavenly coffee, heavenly coffee, heavenly coffee.
Get that good to the last drop. With Maxwell House.
Whether you choose to believe in it or not, coffee divination, the act of reading the future in one's coffee grounds, has been a part of the ritual surrounding coffee since the Arabs began trading it in the early 1400s. Though still common in the Middle East, coffee diviners are rare in the U.S. Anstrain Champs found one such person, though. Barbara Moran.
If you find the truth, you have to speak it or you'll be afraid of it. And we all ask ourselves the same questions. Why am I here? Where did I come from and where am I going? Because we have to make sense of the universe. We have to put things in the past, present, and future.
That makes coffee divination sound cosmic and mystical. Do people tend to use it on that level, or do they use it for very practical things like, should I take the job or should I buy the car?
It can be anywhere. Or what's my future husband going to look like, or am I going to be rich someday? Actually, depending on who's reading, I noticed the Arab women are really big on your love life and your sex life and how other people see you. The Turks tend to stay within the philosophical range and the Greeks into the range of the cosmos. So it depends on who you have read your fortune, how it will be. But I try to stay away from people's sex lives. So I don't know how well the customers know each other. I'm not sure what to share.
Here's our coffee. God, it smells good. What's in Turkish coffee that makes it Turkish coffee?
It's actually just coffee, but very, very finely ground.
But it's not the same as Italian espresso, because isn't it? It's made differently,
yeah, it's
right?
It's not espresso. It's actually cooked in a cezve, which is a little copper pot. and you fill it up to the bend in it with water, and then stir in the coffee and whatever sugar, and you let it come to a boil, and then you take off the foam that forms and put it in the cup.
I've gotten to the point where my coffee is very sludgy. Should I keep drinking the sludge?
Or no.
Can I stop here?
Put the saucer on top.
On top.
Yep, that way. And flip the whole thing over.
Okay.
I will lift up the cup. Soylich halin, chiksen fallen. From this moment in time, your fortune will now be told. You can see that there are things that have appeared there in the cup.
Yeah, it looks like a flame has scorched the bottom of the cup. It's got that flame shape.
Yep.
And there's a sort of dark puddle of mud underneath it.
The things that are towards the rim are things that are happening in the future. This is your destiny that lies in the bottom of the cup.
That puddle of mud?
Look at it clearer, and you can see that it's actually a big tree with a big canopy.
It is, you're right.
And it's sitting upon a very nice chunk of earth. The trunk of the tree is tipped a little to one side.
That's exactly what it looks like, mm-hmm. is a tree standing on top of a hill. Mm-hmm.
You have grown something from a seed that has become big enough to shelter those around you. It's something that is mature enough to produce a harvest. And it's something that, although it's a little more developed on one side than the other, has good balance. And that it's firmly rooted in the earth. That's an excellent symbol to say that you have a creative, productive life.
That's lovely.
There's some other things here. One is this symbol here. It shows two things that can interlock. And what that means is that you can achieve what you can do because you have someone who supports you or things that support you. The other thing that's here that's interesting is that this says that there may be a time in which you will discover that the only way that you can grow is by finding a higher hill to climb. And from that perspective, you'll be able to see things that you carry with you that are burdens in a whole new way.
Which symbol? Show me which symbol says that.
Is this. This is the path up the incline.
Oh, so it looks like there's a little path going up the side of the cup,
mm-hmm.
up to a little kind of plateau.
Mm-hmm. And that what this means is that when you stand at the top and you see all of the things below in perspective, looking back, that you'll be able to take off the burdens and set them there and leave them freed of the things from the past.
Barbara Moran is the owner of the Dardanelles Restaurant and Turkish Coffee Shop in Madison, Wisconsin. Anne Strangechamp spoke with her.
Yes, there's an air about hot coffee that's hard to resist. Full-bodied, refreshing hot coffee makes any time a pleasant interlude. Won't you have some now?
I've seen the light, oh, the light I've seen. Seen the light of St. Caffeine. Of all their drugs, oh, I am clean. But I pray to you, St. Caffeine.
Yeah, but isn't coffee bad for you? Coming up next, a look at the science of caffeine.
There is something in people that makes them somehow turn on easy, simple solutions and suspect them of harboring secret dangers to the soul, sort of a Calvinist streak that induces us to think that if we have an easy way out, somehow we're going to end up paying for it to our sorrow in the end. And in the case of caffeine use, it is a very easy, safe way of getting a lot of benefits, and it's foolish to avoid it.
I'm Jim Fleming. That's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from Watkins Incorporated, purveyors of Watkins vanilla, extracts, spices, and other gourmet ingredients, apothecary remedies, and indulgences for the bath since 1868. WatkinsOnline.com.
The dictionary says caffeine is a vegetable alkaloid crystallizing in white silky needles derived from coffee, tea, and cola nuts and used as a stimulant and diuretic. Not very appealing in such clinical terms. But caffeine is appealing. Very. No matter how you measure it, caffeine is by far the most popular drug in the world, beating out such formidable foes as nicotine and alcohol. But for all its popularity, very little is known about its effects on the human body. What is commonly believed tends to be half-truths and old wives' tales. Bennett Allen Weinberg, author of The World of Caffeine, talked with Anne Strangemps about our drug of choice.
Caffeine is made out of carbon and oxygen and nitrogen. It actually evolved in the plant world as an insecticide, an antimicrobial. And it's very peculiar that this substance that's used by plants to help kill bugs and keep them alive should have such remarkable effects in the human body. But it does. Exactly how it exerts those effects is still somewhat unclear.
That was one of the remarkable things to me in reading your book, is that scientists can't really explain how caffeine works, how it has the effects it has on us.
It is difficult to explain all of its effects. You see, it has many different sorts of effects, and they're not easily explained by one mechanism. The primary mechanism that's usually adduced to account for caffeine's primary stimulating and refreshing qualities is something called the adenosine blockade theory. Now, there's a neurotransmitter in the body, one of many neurotransmitters, that causes us to become sleepy, groggy, or tired. And caffeine attaches itself to adenosine receptors and blocks adenosine from being taken up by the body. And in that way, it prevents us from becoming fatigued or tired. That's fairly well understood. The problem comes in when you consider that caffeine doesn't just augment our faculties when we're sleepy or tired or prolong our freshness. It also augments our faculties when we're completely well rested, which really should have nothing to do with the adenosine system at all. So there are a lot of things going on with caffeine. It's also been found that it affects tissues locally in ways that don't have anything to do with the central nervous system. For example, it's an anti-inflammatory in muscles. It's a strong antioxidant, stronger than vitamin C. When athletes use it, it will protect them from muscle damage. These are things that really aren't readily explained with the adenosine theory.
Wait, caffeine is an antioxidant? It does the same thing that vitamin C does? This makes it sound like it's really good for us.
It is good for you, actually. It's good for you in many ways and may not be bad for you in too many ways at all. Yes, caffeine is a stronger antioxidant than vitamin C. It's about as strong as glutathione, which is the body's natural antioxidant. And coffee, as a matter of fact, contains many antioxidants, not just caffeine. But caffeine is one of the stronger ones.
And antioxidants is what we all think is protective against cancer, right?
Yes, not only cancer, but supposedly within the body, groups of molecules called free radicals initiate chain reactions which cause damage down the line to cell functions and cell structures. And these deleterious changes are supposed to be a fundamental component of the aging process. So presumably, by forestalling these chains of destructive occurrences, we can actually slow the aging process. And that's one of the reasons that people take antioxidants like vitamin E, vitamin C, vitamin A, because they hope to limit the free radical damage. Well, this is something that caffeine can accomplish very readily.
It really makes you wonder why, if that's the case, we all think of it as this unhealthy substance.
Yes, and we have wondered about that ourselves. You know, there is something in people that makes them somehow turn on easy, simple solutions and suspect them of harboring secret dangers to the soul, sort of a Calvinist streak that induces us to think that if we have an easy way out, somehow we're going to end up paying for it to our sorrow in the end. You hear that in the news sometimes. People say, Americans are looking for the easy way out. Well, there is no easy way out. Well, when there is no easy way out, there is none. But when there is one, then you'd be foolish not to take it. And in the case of caffeine use, it is a very easy, safe way of getting a lot of benefits, and it's foolish to avoid it.
You can see how people would think of it as this evil substance because it's, I mean, this is radical. It's something that can make you feel better, and there's no side effect.
Yes, there really doesn't seem to be much to worry about. If, in fact, it doesn't agree with you for some reason, if you, for example, if it keeps you from sleeping, well, then you have to cut down the amount you use or use it earlier in the day. If you're one of the people that's unusually sensitive to it, well, then you also have to minimize your use. But as far as general health impact, there really is no concern.
I think of it as a pretty powerful antidepressant. That's why I drink it.
Very, very important point that you're making. In fact, one of the really critical aspects of caffeine that's often neglected in a way are its mood effects. They really are profound and long-lasting, and they can come from low doses. It's been found that doses as low as 65 milligrams, which is the amount in maybe half a cup of coffee, can produce mood elevation for an entire day. And it really is one of the strongest inducements for using coffee, and why when you walk by a coffee bar you get a kind of good feeling and you feel like maybe going in, is because caffeine is a euphoric. It really makes you feel good. It makes you feel confident, relaxed, tranquil, energetic, and just up. It makes you feel good. And there are not many things in life which can safely and easily make you feel good. And so it's a very strong motivator.
So will you paint a picture for me of what happens when somebody drinks a cup of coffee? What's happening in their body as the caffeine gets into their system?
Well, in the first instance, it's interesting to note that caffeine has a distribution in the body that's really quite remarkable. You know, just a few minutes after ingesting caffeine, it's absorbed by almost every cell in your body. It's both water-soluble and fat-soluble. That means that it just becomes distributed throughout your body in a way that few drugs are, very quickly. And it's present 15 minutes after using it. It's present in virtually all of your tissues, your brain tissues. It's present in semen. It's present in breast milk. And this is one of the secrets to its activity, although, as I say, all the secrets of its activity are not well understood. After that, it does act to block the adenosine receptors, and in this way to forestall the onset of fatigue and to increase freshness and to provide what seems to be the ability to sustain your energies. Beyond that, it affects the neurotransmitter systems in ways that are not well understood.
Anybody who loves coffee knows that, you know, you drink one cup and it feels great, and so you automatically want to drink a second cup and that feels great, and then maybe you think, this feels terrific, I want to drink a third cup. But at a certain point, you stop feeling so great. It's just like you can keep drinking cup after cup and it just doesn't seem to be giving you quite the same buzz anymore. Why is that?
Well, there is a kind of natural ceiling to the effects of caffeine in many ways. A small amount of caffeine will produce a small effect. A larger amount will produce a larger effect. But a really large amount will tend to produce less of an effect.
So it sounds like part of the trick of using caffeine, and it sounds more and more like it's a drug that we use, but part of the trick of it is figuring out what's the exact right dose for you and not going over that.
That's right. It is really, using it is more of an art than a science. It's a strong, psychoactive, addictive drug with many effects. And if you have some principled objection to the use of an addictive drug, you shouldn't use caffeine because that's what it is. But if you're worried about safety profile, you probably don't have much to worry about. Nevertheless, you have to recognize that it is a strong drug. Any drug will have deleterious effects on some people. Any drug has certain caveats that attend its use.
You mentioned that different amounts of caffeine affect people differently and that getting the right amount of caffeine for you is important. One of the things that is tricky about getting our caffeine from coffee is that coffee, you point out, is a pretty unregulated source of caffeine in that the amount of caffeine you may get in a cup of coffee can vary wildly depending on whether you went to Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks.
Yes, it does vary wildly, and there are a number of factors that contribute to the caffeine level. One is how much coffee is used in preparing the coffee. Another is the method used, whether it's filter drip or infusion, for example, whether it's instant coffee. Another is the type of coffee, whether it's Arabica or Robusta. Robusta beans have twice the caffeine of Arabica beans. Another is how long the coffee is steeped. And finally, there's the question of how large the cup is. You know, what is a cup of coffee? A cup of coffee could be 4 or 5 ounces, or it can be 12 or 14 ounces. So you run into just an incredible range of exposures when you consider that your cup of coffee might have 60 milligrams of caffeine or might have 500. It is tricky. It's hard to know, especially if you're not making the coffee yourself. It's hard to get a regular idea of what you're getting. One of the ways to avoid that is if you consider using caffeine pills, where you really do know what you're getting.
Well, for those of us who love coffee, that's no substitute at all.
Well, you're right. You're right indeed.
You know, the other kind of alarming thing is to discover that the amounts of caffeine in decaf vary a great deal also.
Yes, there you really do risk some exposure to caffeine when you might not want it. And the safe thing to do in that is to buy the instant decafs like Sanka, for example, which are really decaffeinated and have virtually no caffeine in them. When you go to a coffee shop and you get their decaf, you're not really sure what they've done with that.
So if I go to Starbucks or my local, you know, good coffee shop and I order a cup of decaf, am I really drinking some caffeine?
I can't say that you are drinking caffeine, but I wouldn't be confident saying that you're not, because all I can say is that field studies that have been done of these coffees show that they contain varying amounts of caffeine, sometimes small amounts, sometimes modest amounts. That's why I say you're sort of taking a chance. It is a difficult matter, and there's no easy solution to it.
Bennett Allen Weinberg and co-author Bonnie Beeler wrote The World of Caffeine, The Science and Culture of the World's Most Popular Drug. He spoke with N. Strange Champs.
I love coffee, I love tea. I love the Java Java and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the Java and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup. Slim me a slug from that wonderful mug, and I cut a rug till I'm snug in a jug. A sliced up onion and a raw one.
Draw one.
Waiter, waiter, percolator. I love coffee, I love tea. I love the Java Jive and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the Java and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
Boy. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to check out any of the recipes you heard on today's show, just check out our website at www.ttbook.org. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Java Jive, program number 1212B.
I love coffee, I love tea.
To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strange Champs, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Charles Monroe Kane, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup. Boy.
PRI, Public Radio International.